Hi, my name's Noreen Jamil, and this is...
Emily Kate Stevens.
Both of us have been diagnosed with long COVID.
And we've created this podcast dedicated to the condition. Welcome to the Long COVID Sessions.
Emily.
My darling, how was your week?
So,
listen, I'm going to preface this with, here comes the amnesia, followed by the gentle prodding where I say, wait, do you remember? All right, so let's hear it.
So look at me. Look, I'm great.
Well, you look amazing.
But after we had our quite upbeat chat last week, I might have had, the worst crash I've had in a while. So off the back of the holidays and the trip and everything, which was still up and down, it was never plain sailing. I really did have a week of utter crap, a proper week of crap. I really got sedentary. My head was so painful. I ended up not even being able to do yoga. I tried to do yoga one day and I got the shakes so badly that it actually scared me. And then I have a big problem with the mental toll of being sedentary, but also my body doesn't feel good when I'm sedentary. And then I feel like I'm probably building up toxins. So then I started doing lymph drainage every day. And I'm back on track, but I really did have to take it easy for some days there. You see, I didn't block it out completely, but actually when you first asked me, I did go, I feel great.
Yeah.
I feel great.
I saw it in your eyes.
Yeah. So I had actually taken a new supplement about 8 days ago.
You did not tell me this.
The whole time I was on that supplement, I had horrendous headaches and felt like utter crap. Only worked out on day 7 of feeling crap. I thought, well, what have I done differently? What have I changed? And I worked out it's because I'd introduced that supplement and I stopped taking it and I woke up the next day without a headache. It was so interesting, Noreen, though, because you know we take these supplements and we just think, oh, doesn't do anything, or there's no real marked improvement, or but it correlated so directly with these really horrible headaches.
You know, I get so excited when we hear about a new supplement that people are taking, and I think I've got a whole like room full at this point of supplements, and then they come through the post, you know, they drop through the door, you're paying stupid import tax on stuff, and they come through and I haven't taken any of them.
Have you not tried any of them?
None of them. I've got natokinase,
because I tried natokinase made me feel horrendous for the whole time I took
it. I'm just too scared to take them.
But you know, I'm still taking Vidicinals 9 over a year. I'm still taking Vidicinals 9.
You don't have blood running through your body anymore. It's just turmeric.
Yeah, but I went back and reviewed some of the things that we've spoken to other people about, like Professor Robert Thomas, all about the microbiome. And actually, the ingredients in the Vidicinals 9 correlate with the polyphenols. Is that what they're called? That he talks about. So I'm going to keep taking it because I feel relatively balanced when I take that. Anyway, Noreen, that's enough of taking the piss out of me.
Oh, but it's so fun. It's made me feel so much better.
How was your week?
Not as good, again, like you. We were so upbeat last week.
Maybe it was just because we got back together after so long. We were so excited about the whole thing. And now reality's kicked in.
Yeah. I was just thinking when you were saying earlier that we had this high, we went on holiday. You know, people do get some ill effects after being on holiday and pushing yourself. But this, the long COVID thing is so much more. It really is. We would never have been floored after a 6-week assignment that we used to do. I would never have felt like this. So it is different. So what I've noticed is that I was so excited over the summer, where I told you that my resting heart rate was down 10 points. It's gone back up 10 points for almost a month now. I hadn't even checked. So that was disappointing. And it kind of explains why I've been feeling so on a slippery slope.
Yeah.
Feeling really well, really well, really well, really well, really well. You know, it's this degradation of the level of wellness is definitely on a downward trajectory. And now I get to the point where I'm completely not sleeping. The last 2 nights, I've watched the whole of 2 Netflix shows in 2 nights. So I'm not sleeping. My heart rate's up. and I'm feeling more allergic-y. And my eyes this time, oh, eyes, actually. We'll come back to your eyes in a minute. My eyes are feeling really sore, but not in the dry kind of way, but in a kind of a, they feel like they're going to water, but they're not watering.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Lovely segue, because actually, Noreen, I'd completely forgotten, but I went to the optician the other day, and I've been going to the optician regularly for the last 3.5 years to try and see if there's anything that I can do to sort out some of these headaches, or at least to just cover all bases to make sure that there's nothing going on with my eyes. First thing she said to me when I went into the room, she said, "You've got long COVID." I said, "Yes. Are you seeing people with long COVID? Do you know what that means?" Previously, all of the opticians I've been in to see, they were not very familiar with it. She said, it's such an interesting area for her. She is seeing two primary things: changes in vasculature of the eye, and people with long COVID have eye muscle weakness.
So the vascular thing, if people want more information, they should go back and listen to our episode.
Bettina Hoberger.
With Bettina Hoberger.
Yeah. It's not equipment that I believe is normally used in a high street optician that Bettina uses. But this optician was saying that she is seeing changes in the vasculature with whatever she uses there. And this eye muscle weakness.
Which is new. We haven't heard about this, have we?
No.
The muscle weakness. I haven't heard that.
No, I hadn't heard it at all. And you know that we talk about all the time how our vision goes blurry. And I was explaining this to her. And honestly, it took her 10 seconds to diagnose me with this eye muscle weakness, where my eyes are basically focusing at different points. They're not working together, so my eyes are battling the whole time. She's put a prism in my lenses, and I haven't got my glasses yet, but she put the glasses on me, put this prism lens in, and I almost cried, because for the first time in ages, I felt like I could see, and I didn't have this kind of dappled vision that I've been repeatedly going to the optician about. It was quite remarkable. She thinks that I might get as much as 50% reduction in my headaches from having that eye muscle weakness corrected. But the other thing, in reference to your eye comment, is she said, "Do you have dry eyes?" I said, "I think they're okay." She looked at them. She said, "Your eyes are so dry that it's almost like you've lost the nerve sensation that's telling your body that they're dry." And I'm also seeing that in long COVID and post COVID. So I now have to have eye drops morning and evening, but I think I'm allergic to them. So when I said to you yesterday, I look like shit, it's because I wake up, I have this kind of red ring around my eye when I get up in the morning, but I've realized that's probably because I'm putting these eye drops in my eye.
In the year after I had COVID, and then from that initial wild strain or whatever we had developed long COVID, we both talked about this in the early shows about how much our eyesight seems to us felt like it had gotten so much weaker. For me, the TV was so blurry, whereas before I could see it quite normally. It's improved.
At all times, though, was it when you were just in the dips? For me, it was when I was in the dip, I could go, "Oh crap, I'm having a long COVID crash because my eyesight's just gone."
It was one of the first things I noticed, to be honest, before I even had my diagnosis, that I felt my eyesight was getting weaker. It wasn't consistent, like we say. But also, it has improved.
Mm.
Anyway, the eyes are important. There you go.
The eyes are important.
We need to chase up BC007.
Yeah.
I tell you, it's sad, though, that we are now thinking about people and trials that we have interviewed in the past and now having to catch up with them. That, who knew that we'd still be doing this 3 years in?
I know, it's shocking, isn't it? That's actually one of the things that our guest this week mentioned, is how initially people were shocked that they were looking at something that was 3 months post-viral, saying that was too long a time period. Now we're looking at this 3.5 years post-viral and we're still sick. Yeah, it is shocking that it's lasted that length of time. So we speak to Michael Peluso, who is an infectious disease doctor and assistant professor of medicine at the University of California in San Francisco. And he works with Stephen Deeks, who we have previously spoken to.
Yeah, we've been trying to get Michael since we spoke to Stephen about 2 years ago. So this was quite a moment for us, actually. And it didn't disappoint.
No. And the two of them together have possibly the longest running study cohort of long COVID patients that there is out there. And so they are now tracking, well, from the time that I had COVID, so three and a half years, they have been tracking people's symptoms and people's illness.
Actually, and what makes it unique, I think, is that it's an actual study rather than, so Jack Lambert was seeing how it was following people post-COVID.
But from his clinic
right at the beginning.
Yeah, whereas these people enrolled them in the study from so early on.
Yeah.
And have a lot of interesting proven observations. It's more than just observations, isn't it? About the effect on T cells, about the viral immunology of it.
Yeah. During the interview, as you'll hear, Dr. Peluso does talk about the need for new studies and trials and is actually looking for treatments.
We spoke to one of your colleagues that you've actually done some papers with, Dr. Stephen Deeks. You and he are part of this Lynx study, which is one of the oldest or longest running long COVID studies that there is.
Yeah, actually, remember when we spoke to Stephen, we were actually surprised by how early you guys had jumped onto that and started collating the data.
So Steve and I have worked together for about 7 years now, initially on HIV, and we were fortunate at UCSF to have a large research infrastructure to study chronic HIV infection dating back decades now. Basically, when COVID started, there were initial rumblings that some returning travelers were returning with COVID in February of 2020. But what happened was in March of 2020, early March of 2020, I was up working in my primary care clinic and got a notification that a person who had not left San Francisco for years had just shown up to the San Francisco General Hospital Emergency Department with symptoms and tested positive for COVID. And that basically meant that it was on our doorstep. So there were huge efforts at that time in March of 2020 to launch studies of acute COVID to understand who was going to get sick, what the risk factors were going to be, how sick people would get, who would be at risk of severe outcomes. But I think what was lost in those initial few weeks was what would happen to people after they had COVID. And I sort of knew at that time that we weren't really well positioned to study the acute infection because of all of the complexities of that, you know, infection control issues. But what our research infrastructure could be really good at was following people long term after they had the infection. And so I'd called up Steve Deeks and Tim Henrich from that room and clinic and said, this is what I think we should do. And so we basically launched the study within a few weeks of that with this focus on what would happen to people after they had COVID. That wasn't based on just a guess. It was based on lots of experience with other infections, knowing that very few infections ever end up being as simple as they are initially billed. And so when this was being described up front as a two-week illness from which people would either get really sick and perhaps die or fully recover within 2 weeks, we sort of knew that it was almost certain to be more complex than that. And unfortunately, within a few days of starting the study, we began to encounter people who had had COVID 4, 6, or 8 weeks prior who were still sick. Through doing that, we became one of the earliest studies of this condition.
When you talk about in your papers, your large observational study, the ongoing study that you are doing now is still dating back to then. You're still using people and data. You are still tracking them from right back then.
That's right. So initially, we framed the study as that it would last for 2 years. Once we hit the two-year mark and recognized that this was going to be an ongoing issue, we extended it to give people the option of being followed indefinitely.
That's depressing.
Yeah. Our first participant was enrolled on April 21st, 2020, and we've continued to enroll people throughout all of the various
different waves,
of the
strains.
Pandemic, and we continue to enroll new people to this day. I just finished up seeing a new participant who's enrolling the study. So we've been in continuous operation now for over 3 years and I think are making some headway into figuring out what's going on, but still there is more that is not known than is known.
You and Stephen published a paper in April 2022 in which you proposed the contributing mechanisms of long COVID. So what are we now? We are another 16 months on from that.
Yep.
How have things progressed or changed through this really, really long study?
Yeah.
In terms of, and we will obviously later get to your recent paper in depth, but the sort of arc of what has happened or what you have found based on what you originally had proposed.
I think we've learned a lot in the last 3 years, although at the same time, it always feels like the progress is too slow. So I think that both of those things are true. I think there are kind of three eras of this, and maybe we're entering a fourth. The first era was really the first 8 months of the pandemic, witnessing what people were experiencing with regard to long COVID and trying to convince the wider world that this was happening and that it was real and that it was important. There was a lot of resistance to this up front, right? A lot of denialism, a lot of people not being taken seriously, a lot of people feeling not validated. And so the first phase of this was trying to sound the alarm that this was happening. Patient groups were really important in doing that. And I think certain institutions, including UCSF, took this very seriously from the beginning and began to talk about it in sort of a scientific way, which was really important, I think, for it to get the attention that it deserves. I think a lot of that skepticism has gone away, but it's certainly not gone away entirely.
When you say it's gone away, do you think it's gone away within the medical community or within the general public? Because I still see quite a lot of denial. Even if you look at our social feed, there will be people who just come and write under one of our posts, long COVID doesn't exist.
Certainly the problem has not gone away, but the I think what we have seen is that there's been a definite shift among the general public about this. There's been a major but probably not complete shift among clinicians. There's been substantial investment on the part of medical institutions to build up programs to address the condition, although not enough. And there's been pretty sizable foundation and government investment in addressing the problem at a pretty large scale in what, in the scheme of science, is a relatively short amount of time.
Yeah.
That being said, I still encounter people who are skeptical. Part of my job is to report what I am seeing in an honest way. And I fully have believed the patients that have been telling me this since the very beginning. And I try to convey that message to convince other people that this is a major problem. There's just impossible to ignore evidence that this is going on. We know from lots of other infections that there are infection-associated chronic illnesses that have been really poorly understood and horribly stigmatized for decades. What I always say is that long COVID is really our best opportunity to understand the biology of these poorly understood conditions, because there was this unique confluence of factors that happened, especially in the early days of the pandemic, where everybody was attuned to the inciting infection, was paying attention, and was actively seeking out confirmation that they could have the infection. And then all of these other things that can cause similar conditions were much less likely to happen because people were at home, people were wearing masks. There were these major public health initiatives going on. And so I really think that this is our best chance to understand not only long COVID, but also similar conditions that are thought to be related to other infections. So I do think that there has been a big shift, but much of that first era, much of that first year was spent trying to convince people that this was important. And in the US, the first formal meeting addressing what became known as long COVID was actually in December of 2020. The NIH convened a bunch of people on Zoom to just talk about their experiences and what they were seeing. And then out of that meeting came, I think, the investment in the Recover program, which is a sizable investment. So that was sort of the first phase of this. The second phase, I think, was really understanding a bit more the epidemiology, understanding who is at risk and who is most likely to be affected by long COVID. And much of the second year was focused on understanding risk factors.
So it is now a shift, also due to vaccination, isn't it? That people are less likely to die from the initial acute infection as well as the differing strains. But there's still not that attention paid to, from what I see, the numbers are not reducing. The number of people that get long COVID from the infection are not reducing, the percentage.
There are great efforts that have been undertaken to try to prove that the numbers are reducing, because I think we would all like that to be true. Vaccination decreases people's risk of getting long COVID. Probably there's lower risk with the newer variants. There's probably lower risk if people are able to get treated during the acute infection. But the risk's not zero, and there's enough COVID around that, like I've said since April of 2020, a small percent of a big number is still a big number. And so the risk is still there.
Long COVID is still a problem. Long COVID is still a problem. And it's now a shift that we're making from the concern over the acute phase into this. And I don't necessarily know that everyone is taking that as sufficiently seriously.
I think that's right.
We will come back to your sort of arc of what you've learned in this time. But the other thing is that I don't necessarily think that we're seeing the number of long COVID patients recover as everyone had anticipated. So I think people were thinking, oh, well, it's a 3-month thing. It's a 6-month thing. It's a 2-year thing. Oh, no, I've still got it 3.5 years later. It's not going away.
Yeah. An interesting observation from having studied this now for so long is that when we began our study and we would frame an individual as having long COVID if their symptoms had lasted more than 3 months, right? And people at that time would say, oh, that's way too long. How could you possibly frame this around 3 months? How could we attribute something to an infection someone had 3 months prior? And now it became 6 months and 12 months. And now I know people who've had this for 3 years. And I think I can say that most people I know that had their long COVID trajectory begin in the early days would say that it's not as bad as it was then, but very few people would feel that they are totally back to what they were.
That is exactly what I would say. I got it in the first wave, and I would say, and Noreen would agree, she observes me closely, that it is not as bad as it was in the summer of 2021, 2022. But it's not gone away. And maybe that just takes time and eventually it will fade to non-existence. But you still get the flares. So there's still something going on.
Yeah. And 2 to 3 years is a long time to be experiencing something like that.
Yeah.
It's quite disruptive for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Would you say that the likelihood of complete recovery after 3 years of illness is almost zero? We can improve our health to a certain level, but that we will still always be vulnerable. I find myself vulnerable to every infection. Every infection I get gives me a long COVID flare. So there's obviously some autoimmune issue going on. Emily and I have very different symptoms, as I'm sure you know how many there are with your link study. But I'm at the point where I am accepting that I will never fully recover.
Yeah.
And there's no smoking gun, as you've been quoted as saying, to say how we each of us can be fixed.
Yeah.
Emily says we're better than we were, but we're also more accepting of where we are. Would you say that, Emily?
Yeah, and therefore better at managing where we are, because we're not just trying to fight against it and become what we were. We've learned a lot about managing our symptoms and the things that we might be able to do to help ourselves in some ways.
Yeah, and I think that what you're describing is an approach to chronic illness in general, unrelated to COVID too, right? People, whenever they have an illness that causes prolonged issues, have to adapt to that. And the hope is that we will figure this out and be able to correct whatever the underlying process is. But that is, you know, we're not there yet.
Yeah. So if we go back to, you went through the first year, the second year, in the third year, you proposed that the mechanisms included viral persistence, reactivation of herpes virus potentially, which is something that seems to have recurred throughout a lot of the studies and a lot of the people that we've spoken to, the underlying autoimmune conditions. We're now into the fourth year of this, aren't we?
Uh-huh.
Into the fourth year. Do all of those still stand?
Yeah, I think all of those still stand. And there's a growing body of evidence for each of them. When we wrote that brief article a year and a half ago, it was laying out what we saw as kind of the key areas of mechanistic investigation to try to figure out whether these things could be found or whether they should be dismissed. That list of things we proposed was certainly not exhaustive, but was what we were seeing in our local study as potentially important. Each of them has had a growing body of evidence behind them over the last year and a half. And so we've not really been able to completely discard any of those mechanistic theories. Where we're at now is that there are sort of varying levels of compelling evidence for each of them, but we're sort of at the phase where we need to begin to actually test this in a way that is more active than simply measuring people. And so what I mean by that is, right, so the first era of this was recognizing the problem and getting people to buy into that we have to solve the problem. The second era of this was describing who was most likely to get this condition. The third era of this was laying out the potential biology. The current era of this now needs to be proving that each of those mechanisms is or is not driving this. And the way you do that, in my opinion, in our opinion here, is that you actually have to intervene on those pathways to see if you can change either a biological measurement or change how people feel. And so what that means to us is trying to do these intense proof of concept, experimental medicine type studies where we identify a target pathway that we want to alter because we think it is contributing. And then we try to alter it by giving an investigational treatment. And then we see what happens. And whether our hypothesis was correct, that we can make a difference by doing that.
So the viral persistence theory would be the Paxlovid trial. Is that right?
One component of the viral persistence theory would be the Paxlovid trial. That doesn't address the full issue, right? So antivirals like Paxlovid or other antivirals work on replicating virus. So the virus has to be replicating in order for the medication to have an effect. We know that there are pieces of virus, but we don't know that that virus is actually replicating.
So that means it has to be active virus.
Right. It has to be reproducing.
Right.
Because that's how those antivirals work. And so let's use an example of a totally unrelated virus, which is HIV, right? So HIV, totally different type of virus, mechanism of persistence, totally different. But a person who's living with HIV has the HIV reservoir, this virus that's smoldering under the surface.
Is that in the tissues again in HIV?
In HIV, it's primarily in tissues and in cells that traffic in and out of tissues. And the vast majority of the virus in a person with HIV is in these cells that are in tissues. And then there's the replicating virus that we can measure in blood. When we take a patient with HIV and put them on HIV medications, antiretroviral therapy, that tamps down the replicating virus that's present in their blood, but it doesn't eradicate the reservoir. And so we know from HIV, when a person is on HIV meds, they become undetectable, their health improves, they have normal life expectancy, they can transmit to others. But basically, as soon as they stop those medications, that replicating virus comes back because this underlying reservoir is not cleared. Now, again, the mechanism of SARS-CoV-2 persistence may be totally different. It's a different type of virus. But the point I'm trying to make is that an antiviral may not be the be-all, end-all solution for viral persistence as a driver of long COVID.
So it might be able to suppress any active virus, but it might not remove.
Depending on where that virus resides, it may not actually eradicate the underlying problem. And if there are pieces of virus that are not replicating, that are causing an immune response, I would not expect an antiviral like Paxlovid to have any impact. I actually think that it's terrific that those studies are happening. And those were among the first studies that should be happening. But I don't think that if those studies turn out to be negative, it takes the idea of viral persistence off the table, because it hasn't really addressed fully that sort of other aspect of the problem.
I think your explanation with the HIV comparison has just made me able to see how it operates.
Because they haven't really found replicating virus in people with long COVID. They have found debris, which they think is what's driving the immune response.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So first of all, it's very hard in general to find replicating virus in situations like this. The fact that it hasn't been found doesn't mean that it's not there.
Right.
Very, very hard to do. But that being said, that specific mechanism of action of that class of drug would only work if there was replicating virus. So if somebody did a Paxlovid study and everybody benefited, there was clear benefit, that would be circumstantial evidence that there must be replicating virus that we're just not seeing. If we do a Paxlovid study and the result turns out to be negative, that's incredibly important. I mean, obviously everybody would be disappointed, but that's incredibly important to know. But it doesn't take off the table the fact that there could be this debris, which we are seeing, that could be partially contributing to this. So there are other treatments that you could think about
that you would do alongside, potentially.
That you would do alongside or instead of an antiviral.
So what class of drugs are those, or what type of treatments is that?
That would be targeting what we would call the reservoir, and the types of medications that you could think about for that are things like monoclonal antibodies. So I've been saying from the beginning that I really think that one of the most important studies to do in long COVID are studies of anti-SARS-CoV-2 monoclonal antibodies, because those antibodies, in theory, most of them target spike protein, right? So they would neutralize the protein that we think we're seeing. If that protein is expressed on the surface of a cell, they could potentially help to clear that infected cell. And monoclonal antibodies or other sort of therapeutic antibodies also have other potentially beneficial immune functions that they can help in some cases to recalibrate the immune system to better target whatever the antigen is. And so I think that that class of drugs, even though they are now defunct for acute COVID, right? Acute COVID mutated away, there are no monoclonal antibodies currently in the armamentarium for somebody who has COVID from XBB or whatever the new variants are going to be named. But that doesn't mean that monoclonal antibody wouldn't work against the prior variant that is still harbored by somebody. We've been developing here at UCSF a study of anti-COVID monoclonal for people with long COVID who were infected with a susceptible variant to see if we can get them to feel better.
That's one of the things with these monoclonal antibodies. It's not just a kind of blanket drug you can give to people. It's very specifically targeted to that antibody of that strain. Is that correct?
Well, there were different generations of monoclonal antibodies, right? So the first one that got a lot of attention, I think, was the one from Regeneron. Once the Omicron strains came, that didn't work anymore. And then there was one from Eli Lilly and another company called Vir. And then those eventually escaped as well. So you have to be thoughtful about when you think somebody had an infection and which monoclonal you might give in the context of a research study. But that's something that even if all of the antiviral studies with Paxlovid turn out to be negative, I think it would still be important to address the other aspect of viral persistence in that way. And there's rationale for that too, because I'm sure you remember when vaccines rolled out that a subset of people with long COVID felt very strongly that they improved in the context of getting a vaccine. That was definitely not everybody, but I know some people who their symptoms went away and in some cases stayed away. And so that sort of proof of concept for that mechanism, that recalibrating the immune response toward potential clearance of a viral reservoir can be of benefit.
Yeah, because it's your body almost coming in and giving the virus a massive kick out, whatever is left in there.
Yeah, so I sort of see those as related things.
Tell us about your actually finding viral persistence in your recent study and your paper, which I think is currently in preprint. Because actually, what you've done here is you have proof of viral persistence in living patients without invasive biopsies. You're not looking at autopsies. You have proof of viral persistence in living people with long COVID.
Well, there are two things. So there's first this observation that was made last summer by David Walt's group from Harvard, led by Zoe Swank. They thought they were able to measure pieces of spike protein in the blood of people, living people with long COVID, up to a year after they had COVID. Wasn't everybody, but that went against the paradigm that this shouldn't be present anymore. There was also a really nice study that I'm sure you're familiar with from Dan Chertow's group at the NIH, doing autopsies in people who previously had COVID for up to 6 months after they had COVID, and those individuals died from another reason. And they found pieces of virus in tissues from certain people for up to 6 months. It wasn't a huge number of individuals in that study, but really important study. It was published in Nature earlier this year. But you can't do brain biopsies and heart biopsies in living people. So we have two really, I think, unique and important programs here at UCSF that, again, were developed years ago for our efforts to study HIV, but have now been recalibrated to also study COVID. And so the first of those programs is a really robust imaging program led by Tim Henrich and Henry Van Brocklin that focuses on understanding whole body immune responses in people related to infection. While you can't do brain biopsies and heart biopsies and lung biopsies and liver biopsies in people, you can scan them using a PET scanner. And Tim and Henry have developed, in these large collaborations with others, these unique tracers that can show things like immune cell trafficking to tissues. And so the initial purpose of the study that we're talking about now, this preprint that was posted a couple of weeks ago on MedArchive, was to do this imaging in people after they had COVID. And so what we did was we took about 24 people, 1 month to 2 years post-COVID, some of whom had long COVID, some of whom felt totally fine. And we did these scans, scanning them from their brain to their ankles with this tracer that shows immune cell activity. And we found that people had much more activity than we used to see before the pandemic. These were all people who previously had COVID. And so that was really surprising. We know that people post-COVID and with long COVID sometimes have higher levels of inflammation measured in their blood, but it was really striking to see this in the tissues. We saw increased activity in the spinal cord, in the heart wall, in the lungs, in the GI tract.
In everybody, so supposedly healthy and people with long COVID.
All of these people had COVID. Some of them had long COVID. Others said that they had fully recovered. There was sort of a stepwise increase. People who felt fine were sort of at this middle level, and then some people who had long COVID were at a higher level. The numbers are small, so not everything was statistically significant, but the trend is clearly there even when the statistics are not. And then the second thing that we did to then try to answer the question of what could this be related to was we said, well, let's see who among this group with long COVID is willing to do a gut biopsy. Those people were willing to come in and do what's called a flexible sigmoidoscopy, which is like a mini colonoscopy where they come in and they get biopsies of their rectal tissue. That's done by a collaborator here named Ma Samsuk, who's a gastroenterologist and pioneered this to study HIV a decade ago, and now is doing these procedures for research to see what we see. And we found in 4 of the 5 people who got biopsies that we're able to identify what we think are pieces of SARS-CoV-2 RNA, so genetic material, in the gut biopsy tissue, primarily in cells that seem to be deeper tissues of the gut wall. So not just on the surface, where you might expect them to be if somebody has an acute infection, but farther down and in association with different types of immune cells. That is consistent, I think, with the autopsy findings and is a thing that is surprising. 3 years ago, we wouldn't have expected to see that, but we think that we're seeing it. The numbers are small so far, but we're building out that program now.
Did you biopsy anyone of the cohort who did not have long COVID?
So that's the most important question. And the answer to that is not for that study, because we were limited to who we could enroll to people who had long COVID to start. But now we have some foundation support from PolyBio to expand that study, expand that program, and do those procedures in people with long COVID as well as people who had COVID and don't have long COVID. So that's going to be a major effort over the next year to do that.
I think one of the most standout things that you've said to me so far is that in these PET scans, you see increased activity amongst everyone, which should be alarm bells for everybody, really.
Yeah, it's not just those of us with long COVID.
It's not benign. It's not a flu. It does alter you. And if you survive the first time, you know, without getting long COVID, you may not the second or the third or the fourth. And so what we're doing to our kids by putting them into school without any mitigation is just awful, I think.
We always think of our homeostasis, right? Our steady state of being immunologically, right? Or physiologically. This certainly doesn't definitively prove anything, but it makes one wonder whether COVID as a widespread infection that has affected pretty much everyone whether that has had the potential to kind of shift our normal immune homeostasis and what that could mean. The question that I think Emily asked about, well, is this present in people who don't have long COVID? That's a really important question, because it may not be that any one of these mechanisms in and of itself is sufficient to cause long COVID. But it might mean that some combination of things in relation to other factors that we're not even thinking about can all be necessary, but none of them on their own would be sufficient to cause long COVID. And I think that that's how I'm thinking about this more and more, are these interconnected pathways, and we need to try to disrupt different components of each one of these pathways to see whether there's an effect. If there is an effect that suggests that that pathway is worth pursuing further for therapeutic studies. If there's no effect, then pursuing that pathway in isolation may not be the right move, but it may not entirely take it off the table. So what we're seeing now, I think, harkens back to the early days of the HIV pandemic, when the initial treatments that were rolled out to try to treat HIV were single agent treatments, and eventually those became combination treatments. And I think what we're seeing now is the first phase of clinical trials for long COVID or single interventions. But I think there will likely be some signals from that, but perhaps not complete. And I think the next phase of that will probably be combination studies of trying to attack two different mechanisms that could be related. I think that's where this is going.
So it's almost as if you've got layers. So you have COVID, but you had an underlying autoimmune situation that perhaps you were not aware of. Plus you had HHV6 dormant in your cells. And so it's this combination of things, which you then have to come in with a cocktail. Isn't that what it's always described in HIV, as a cocktail? You have to come in with a cocktail of things that address the various different things together. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, it's similar to that. With HIV, the cocktail that you described was all basically targeting the same thing.
Okay.
So it's a little bit different, right?
Okay.
But what I'm saying is we need to start to draw the arrows between the different mechanisms. So if you look at the figure in our paper from last year, the mechanisms were basically in columns, right? They were silos. But I think where the field is moving is trying to understand all of the arrows that connect those different mechanisms to figure out which pathways we can block. And that might require a combination of different treatments. That being said, for all clinical trials, the most important outcome is safety. And so you cannot take lightly the potential risks that come with combination approaches. And so I think that even though I believe that that's where the field is going to move in the next couple of years, it needs to be done really carefully and cautiously to make sure that treatments that target maybe different aspects of contributors to long COVID don't create some dangerous side effect for people.
Yeah, the interactions between them.
Yeah, exactly. A simple example of that is colchicine and Paxlovid. A subset of patients with long COVID over the last couple of years have been prescribed colchicine.
Me.
Noreen.
I'm not here to endorse colchicine or say it works or not, but there is an absolute contraindication to take colchicine with Paxlovid.
Yeah, I took Paxlovid after I got COVID in...
The third time.
So my third bout of COVID in March. And Paxlovid seemed to really help me. I didn't get the long COVID rebound I normally do after an infection, but I had to stop taking colchicine because I know it interacts with all the heart meds.
Yeah. So right now we're beginning clinical trials looking kind of individual interventions. I think what's coming is probably combinations of different approaches, but really needs to be done in a safe and kind of structured way because a lot of different medications can interact with one another, and we would hate for someone to have a dangerous adverse effect.
There's a lot of people self-medicating on high-dose supplements and antivirals because the community, the cohort's desperate for answers, right?
So they're for sure
looking at every bit of new research and then trying something new without, we say this every week, got to be careful. There are interactions.
But for sure.
There are interactions. And with those unregulated things, the interactions are not necessarily known or they've not actually been tested against each other.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I totally understand the need for people to try to feel better. And again, this is another parallel to what happened 30 years ago with HIV. People just need to be mindful of and be cautious.
Tread cautiously. And then that's another thing. So many of the doctors that we speak to say, we feel very frustrated. I know the community does as well, but the doctors say, we feel very frustrated that we can't move more quickly.
Yeah.
But when it comes to it, we all have to move only as quickly as we can safely.
Yeah. I mean, if you were to compare the work being done and the speed with which work is being done on COVID compared to HIV, would you say we're outpacing that if you could compare the two diseases, or are we similar?
I do think we are going quicker.
Yeah.
It feels like all things COVID have happened on an accelerated timeline. I don't want to give the impression that I think things are happening quickly enough. I understand and feel the same frustrations, but in terms of the expected typical pace of things, this has actually been quite fast. Doesn't mean it's fast enough, and I think it will accelerate more.
Yeah. So why don't we talk about your new trial?
So we're in the process of developing a number of studies here at UCSF, some in partnership with the RECOVER program that we'll be participating in, others kind of separate and based at UCSF or part of other collaborations. But what I'm most excited about is this program that we're developing, as I mentioned, using COVID monoclonal antibodies. What we'll be doing in that study is identifying a few dozen people who are experiencing long COVID, deeply characterizing their long COVID symptoms. People who qualify for the study, we will be randomizing them 2-to-1 to get either this monoclonal antibody or placebo, just saline. And then we'll track people carefully over time in terms of their symptoms, in terms of other objective parameters, various health scales, and lots of blood measurements to see whether targeting a potential viral reservoir could have an impact on how people feel or what we're seeing going on in their blood.
What's the sort of time frame of a monoclonal antibody treatment, or what time frame are you using for that study? Is it a singular IV dose? Is it multiple? How long does that trial go on for?
This study is of a monoclonal antibody that was developed by a company called Arium, which has been a really wonderful partner and really very deeply invested in the science and understanding the biology of long COVID. It basically worked through the fall of 2022. It was an investigational monoclonal antibody that was being developed, but then the variants that came out later last year escaped. And so the criteria for enrollment are people with long COVID attributed to an infection prior to September of 2022. And to directly answer your question, it's a single infusion because the antibody has a long half-life. So we think that people will be on a therapeutic dose for up to 6 months after getting the infusion. So it doesn't require multiple infusions for the study. The primary endpoint is at 3 months for the study. If there is a benefit, we would expect that it is sustained, but we'll see. You know, I think it's very important for studies like this to be randomized and blinded. So of the 30 or so people who will be enrolled, 20 will receive the antibody, 10 will receive placebo. They won't know, we won't know until the study's over. I think we're going to learn a lot, and hopefully this will help to answer more directly that question that I brought up at the beginning of whether there's a reservoir of virus or protein that needs to be taken out of commission to get people to feel better.
Just for my knowledge, and I'm sure the listeners wouldn't know this either, what the difference is between monoclonal antibodies and IVIG?
So IVIG is basically a pool of all sorts of antibodies that are taken from blood donors, basically. And so there are thousands of different antibodies in a bag of IVIG. A monoclonal antibody is an antibody that is singular. There's only one thing in that bag. It's an antibody that targets a specific domain on the spike protein of SARS-CoV-2. We know exactly what's in there. There's nothing else in there. So IVIG has lots of different purposes in various medical treatments, but it's not targeted in the same way.
Non-specific.
Yeah. If this worked, there's only one mechanism by which it could work. And we know what that is, right? So it's a much more specific, much more targeted treatment.
That's interesting because there is a trial in DC, I think, that's
right,
offering IVIG.
The NIH trial led by
Javi Nath. Yeah.
So that's a great study group, and they have a lot of experience in running clinical trials. I am aware that they are doing an IVIG trial, I think specifically for people with neurocognitive long COVID symptoms.
What's quite interesting about that is that because it's non-targeted, it might work, but you won't necessarily know the mechanism by which it's working or what specifically it's working on.
I'm sure they will take very many measurements to try to figure out mechanistically what happened if it were to work.
Mm.
And IVIG has immunomodulatory properties separate from the direct action of the antibodies. In our study, the mechanism that we are testing is SARS-CoV-2 spike persistence. And if it works, that is the mechanism by which it would have worked. There can't be like a second secret mechanism. And so it's a much more targeted intervention, specifically, like I said, addressing that mechanism of viral persistence, but not necessarily of a replicating viral reservoir.
And where are you with your enrollment on that?
We are hoping to launch soon. So we're beginning to screen people for the study, and I'm hoping a month from now we'll be fully open. It's all approved and it's posted on clinicaltrials.gov.
Fabulous.
It's interesting because you could do them your study, but if there is replicating virus deep in the tissues, it may still not work, right?
If there's replicating virus, it would still work.
It would still work? So it works on both just the debris and the replicating virus?
Yeah, that's right. Assuming that the virus was a strain that was susceptible, which we think it was, because that's an enrollment criterion, and that it hasn't so dramatically mutated that it's something else, it would work against both replicating and non-replicating virus. So that's sort of the theoretical benefit compared to an antiviral like Paxlovid.
So you've got this study coming up. Are there any other things that you would really, I know there are a lot of things globally that you would like us to look at, but are there any other things coming up that you are going to take a deep dive into or conduct studies on in the near future?
So our first study is focused on mechanisms of viral persistence. I think based on our preliminary work, the next area that we're going to be trying to intervene on is this immune activation and inflammation separate from viral persistence, because that could be a mechanism that's acting totally independently of residual virus. I can't talk in detail about it now, but in the fall, I'm hoping that there will be at least two studies in addition to what we're already doing, focused on targeting pathways of inflammation in people with long COVID to try to recalibrate and calm down what might be a counterproductive immune response that can be contributing to symptoms. I can let you guys know when there are more details to share publicly about those.
Yeah, please do. We would love to talk to you about it.
So, you know, just to end on this, the year four of this for our group is really beginning to shift to apply what we've learned in the first 3 years from doing all this observational work to these interventions, with a focus on these small, intense studies aimed at better defining the biology and hopefully helping people to feel better. I feel more hopeful now at this point than I have at any point prior, despite the fact that we are 3 years into this without answers. Because I think that we are finally beginning to build the momentum and get to the place where we need to be. And like you were getting at before, the pace is not fast enough, but it's moving quite quickly now. And so I'm hopeful that we can maintain this momentum and get people the help that they deserve.
Actually, Emily and I both say a week in, week out, because we speak to all of the guys working on the front line, that we think it's going tremendously fast.
Yeah, we do. We understand people's frustrations, but from our perspective, despite having long COVID and wanting to get better, I think it's also because we speak to people like you and Stephen, who have put so much work into it over the past 3.5 years. A lot of the doctors, researchers working on it couldn't actually have done more work or moved faster than they have.
Yeah, there's nobody that is not affected in some way by this. We all know people who are experiencing it, whether it's, you know, our friends, family, our patients, ourselves. And so I think everybody is so motivated to get answers, and I'm hopeful that that's what the next couple of years will bring.
Oh, they're a great team working on it at University of San Francisco. And Tim Henrich, who is mentioned in that interview, has also agreed to come and talk to us. So that is something exciting to look forward to. Another piece of the puzzle there.
Actually, I've reached a point now where we've been doing this for so long, and you'd think, okay, everyone's still sick. Millions of people are unwell and continuing to get unwell because people are still getting COVID and developing long COVID, that there'd be so many more people doing research and so many more people out there trying to find what's going on or a cure. But when we sit down and we talk about who we should have on the show, we seem to be going back to people who we interviewed a while ago and trying to catch up with them, because there's not that many more new people in the field.
No, and it's interesting that there are actually a lot of them we have interviewed. There seem to be these real big hitters who are forming groups. They attended the long COVID symposium in New Mexico at the end of last month. They are all the ones that are cited in all the articles. They are part of the PolyBio collective. They're all the same people. And those people are incredible. There are some absolutely incredible people doing it. They're carrying a lot of work. A huge amount of work if we're relying on just that small group of people to get us out of this mess.
It's very clear to me now that we have the group who are looking at this particular disease. The group is not growing per se in any statistical measurable way. It's not like we're seeing a 10% increase in doctors and researchers looking at long COVID. We're not. And I think that's actually quite sad for me, because if we're still just this niche disease, it's going to take so much longer for people to, or even for people to be bothered that, you know, we do need looking after.
And I guess the other thing with that is that some of this is therefore not filtering out into mainstream medicine, into all of the hospitals and all the long COVID clinics. It's not necessarily filtering out. It still remains quite specialized specialist studies that needs to actually infiltrate the community. We can come on here and be all upbeat and try and bring our professional A game for our audience. But it's essentially between us stolen 6 years of our life. And that's not to say that we haven't had moments within the 3 years each that have been lovely. But it has reduced our life so considerably. Our earning potential, our ability to enjoy things that we did before. It's really not okay.
No, I went through a bit of a depressive week as well this week. Just really feeling like, you know, a little bit worthless. A bit of a waste of space.
That is down also to how our worth is measured by society. You know, we live in a world where your worth is how much you do, how much you can achieve, the busyness of your life, having a big life. You can't do that with long COVID. So society deems you to be worthless. It's not true. You're not worthless. Look at all the joy you bring to all your listeners and to your family and friends.
Actually, this is why we do the How Was Your Weeks, because 1 week we sound amazing and then the following week we were like, oh. This is the whole reason we do How Was Your Week, because you can't measure your life any longer than that.
No. And there's such variation, isn't there, between the week. And what's really interesting is, especially if you look back over it, is it's not just the physical fluctuations, it's very much the mental fluctuations, not necessarily correlating directly to the physical fluctuations, although you know I get that massively dark mood before I crash. But us kind of philosophizing about it, some weeks we're able to weather it and some weeks it just overwhelms us. Join us next week as we hear others' experiences of long COVID. Share your stories and questions at tlcsessions.net. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram for the latest updates. And if you found this interesting, please do subscribe.